The Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, verses 27 through 38. Jesus and his disciples went to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Christ." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Whenever I hear somebody use that old phrase, "Oh, I guess it's just my cross to bear," I cringe. It just drives me crazy. Because what they're saying is, life has thrown me something that I can't handle, and I just have to stoically put up with it. And besides that, they seem to think that somehow this is tied to what it means to be a Christian. And that's just wrong. Being a Christian is not just stoically putting up with crap that life throws at us. It just isn't that. In fact, Jesus said, "I came to give you the rich, full, abundant life." I believe when Jesus is talking about taking up your cross and following me, he's trying to kind of slap us awake, trying to shock us out of our regular way of thinking and saying, it is these false conceptions about what God and what life is about that are keeping you from living the real life. Taking up your cross is a path of transformation in your life. And it works counterintuitively. You move from death into what is the real life. He's worried about whether people are getting his message, so he asks his disciples, "Well, who are people saying that I am? Are they getting the point?" And they say, "Well, they think you're some illustrious leader like Elijah, the great prophet of old who's come back to welcome in the Messiah, or you're John the Baptist come back from the dead, again, a great prophet to announce God's will." And Jesus goes, I'm not either of those. So he asks his disciples, "You've been with me. I've been teaching you personally. Do you get any more closely who I really am?" And Peter says, "You're the Messiah." And Jesus goes, "Bingo." Because the Messiah is the one who is going to be sent from God to bring God's light and mission to life in this world. So he says, "Bingo, you get it." And he says, "And as part of that job, I'm going to have to die, but 3 days later, I will be alive. I will be raised to the new life, the real life that God wants all of us to live." And Peter goes, "Shut up. I don't want to hear this. What's wrong here?" He has a vision in his mind based entirely on this world's standards of what the Messiah should be. He thinks the Messiah should be the one who rallies the troops and gets the Jews to rise up in rebellion against the hated Romans and throw them out of the country and raise up this great king of Israel. Jesus goes, "That's not going to get us anywhere." They've been fighting that fight for decades. They've been fighting that fight for centuries. That goes nowhere. So he says, "Peter, you're not thinking in terms of what God is thinking. You're thinking in terms of this world." He says, "If you want to really get it, if you want to follow me, you have to take up your cross and begin this process of transformation. If you want to save your life and live your life purely in terms of what this world defines as success, You're going to miss the whole point. But if you let that go, if you're not clinging to it and basing your life on that, then the new life can come. A couple weeks ago, I had the privilege of going to a wonderful conference on spirituality. And there are about 500 people there, and I only knew about a dozen of them. So if you wanted to talk with somebody, you had to go up to strangers and strike up a conversation. But they were all lovely people, and it wasn't a pastor's conference. The majority of these people were lay people, passionate about learning and growing in their faith. Well, after one of the day's sessions were over, we were walking all across the grounds of the resort to a pavilion out there where we were going to have a banquet for supper. And I caught up to this guy who was walking alone on the trail, and I thought, I'll take his chance and just strike up a conversation with him. And guess what? He was a Lutheran pastor, just like me. So I thought, great. And we started talking about, where we'd been and what our stories were. And he said about 8 years ago, he got a call to a church in Portland, Oregon, which was his dream call. The West Coast couldn't get any better than that. Beautiful part of the country. I said, well, that's great. That's wonderful. And he says, yeah, but wait. A couple of years after that, in 2009, our National Lutheran Church started the debate about how open are we going to be to gay people. And he said, all of a sudden, my church just erupted in conflict. Half of the people hated this idea. Half of the people were open to this idea. And he said, we fought. We fought like cats and dogs. And finally, we brought it all to a big congregational vote. And just by the thinnest majority did the people say that we're going to stay in this Lutheran church. We're going to be open to gay people. And he said, and I said, well, that's great. That's great, huh? He says, no, after that, I lost half of my congregation. I lost half of my money. And I said, oh, that's terrible. Trying to sympathize with him. And he says, no, but wait. What? This is like a roller coaster ride here. He said, after that, we were seen as an open, more open church, and people started joining us. Gay people started joining us. And I said, well, that's great. And he says, yeah, but wait. Because they had lost half of their people, they'd lost half of their money, they weren't able to keep going with the programs that they used to have. And their Sunday school had deteriorated. And so the new people who came, including gay couples, wanted their kids to enter Sunday school, and there wasn't a good Sunday school, so they left and went to another church that could support bigger programs. And he felt betrayed, and I said, oh, that's terrible. And he says, yeah, but wait. Said, I thought it was as bad as it could be, but because of all the stress that he had, his health failed him. And he'd been on disability for 2 years and hadn't worked for 2 years. I said, oh, that's got to be terrible. And he says, yeah, but wait. He says, now I don't have the income that I thought I have. I don't have this beautiful church on the West Coast that I thought I had. But I have my home. I have my wife. And now I get to be a grandfather. Now my wife and I have the privilege of being able to take care of our grandchildren. And now at the age of 60, I'm learning to ride a bike again because the grandkids are saying, come on, let's go riding. At the age of 60, I am learning how to climb up the ladder to the slide at the local playground because my kids want me to go sliding with them. And at the end of that, what just really got me, he said, you know, all this talk about dying and rising again to new life, he said, I'm starting to understand it. He says, I hate it. I don't like it. It feels like death, but I'm beginning to trust it just a little bit. When Jesus is saying, take up your cross, if you're holding on to your life here, you're going to lose it all. What he's saying, I think, is he says, you are not the person who you think you are. Why would you let your self-image, as limited and as bound up in ego, define who you are? It's not enough. Because we're either thinking always too much of ourselves. We're thinking, I'm right. I'm the smartest one in the room. People should be listening to me. I can tell you what to do. And does that cause us anything but trouble in our lives? No. Or we go to the opposite extreme and we think we're nothing. We think we're no good, we're worthless, We're always second-guessing and doubting ourselves. And if that's not the reality either, and if we base our lives on that, we're going to be miserable. Jesus says, why would you let that define your life? When Jesus says, take up your cross, he's saying, you are not the person that everyone else thinks you are. In your heart, you know that's right. There are only a few people in our lives who can actually help define us, and they are the people who love us the most. And they are the ones who help us to grow the most in our lives. But even they, because they're frail, fragile human beings, will let us down. Let us down even sometimes at key points in our lives. But most people around us have one of three reactions to us. They're either building us up and putting us on a pedestal and saying, oh, you're right, you're the best, this or that, whatever. And you know in your heart you're not that. Or else they're putting you down and saying, oh, you can't do anything right. You know, why are you always botching up? They're always critical. And you know that's not the reality of your life, although we listen to it too much. Or else they're just plain ignoring us. Why would we let other people define who we are? When Jesus says, if you lose that, you will gain the life that matters, Jesus is the only one who is capable of defining who you really, truly, and absolutely are is God. He's saying, look at how God looks at you. God is looking at you right now, just as you are, absolutely and only with love. God looks at you just as you are and says, just as you are my beloved child right now. And all my gifts and my love and my forgiveness, they're already yours right now. And the only thing that is keeping you from having them is that you think you're not that. You think you're defined by yourself, your own little ego, or what other people says. But it's not the case. Jesus says, why would you let anything but love define who you are? That pastor I visited with, I mean, in a way, he taught me more than all those great speakers that I listened to there. Because he said, I thought my identity was to be this big, successful West Coast pastor. That failed me. That crumbled. He said, well, then I thought I could be this great reformer, this great innovative pastor welcoming all sorts of people, but that betrayed me. He said, in the end, I thought at least I have my health, and even that failed him. In the end, who was his most basic identity? A grandparent, receiving the unconditional love of his grandchildren and giving the unconditional love that only a grandparent can give back in return. He says, out of death comes that new life. He says, I don't like it, but I can trust it. Sometimes stories help us get at the root of these. I found a little fascinating book at that workshop. It's called Tales of a Magic Monastery. I'd like to share this one. This guy, the narrator is a monk. He says, I had been a few years in another monastery, and things were not going well. I persuaded someone to inquire around and find out what other monks thought of me. His report, they call you nobody. Why would we let other people define us? That was terrible to hear. Some of the people in my head started shouting in a rage. No, I'm somebody. Somebody. Others moaned, no, it's not true. You are nobody. The great debate, it went on for months, all inside my head. It wore me out. Somebody, nobody. Somebody, nobody. Why would we let our little egos and anxieties define us? One night, someone came into my room, got on his knees, and put his head to the foreground. I thought he was mocking me, so I ignored him. After a while, I gained courage and began to curse him, but he still stayed. I finally spat at him, and he spoke, please, come to the magic monastery. I tried to make some reply, but the words came out all stutters and stammers. The debate was tearing me apart. He just put out his hand, and I took it and followed him. Let go. Die. Take up your cross. As we walked the path through the great door of the monastery, the bells began to ring as if it were a great feast. The abbot, the leader of the monastery, came to greet me and led me into a huge hall. He put me in the center, and the monks and the nuns, hundreds of them, came and sat all around me. Someone brought a candle from the sanctuary to set in front of me, and so we sat all through the night. Now, if you had been there, you might say we sat in silence with our eyes closed. But this is the Magic Monastery, and my experience was different. I heard them chanting, "Somebody, somebody, at last, at last, welcome, welcome." I heard the abbot tell them how he had just got back from a long exile in Egypt. We were all breathing as one. Someone invited me to sing for them, and I said, "Oh, I couldn't sing, but I would try and tell a few jokes." Again, we're trying to find ourselves. One said it was good to have a new perspective, but then somebody called out, "You can sing." So I sang. I sang the song of my life, my past, my present, my future, and it was so, so beautiful. Jesus wants to shock us awake with this talk of dying and rising again, to shake us loose from all that we hold on to that prevents us from being what God knows we are. He's trying to get us to stop listening to all these other voices trying to define us so that we will listen to the one true voice, His voice, whispering the only truth there is into our ears, whispering, "Somebody, you are somebody. You are always somebody to me."